اللهم بيش تي نغدا بيزو God bless you all في أمان الله.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن. كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
The history of the land of Palestine.
Part 5.
As I look to the north, I see the fertile plains of Syria and Lebanon. In the east, the vast and bountiful valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates. And in the west, the land of the Egyptians. These were the words spoken by Menachem Begin, the former Prime Minister of Israel. However, his words were in contradiction with the previous discourse of the Zionists. Previously, the Zionists spoke of exile, the Holocaust, and oppression. But after formation of Israel, their language and speech changed. They utilized a new terminology that reflected a dangerous ideology. The Greater Israel. To them, the establishment of the Zionist regime on Palestinian land was just the beginning of a larger plan. Therefore, Ben-Gurion claimed, "This map is not our country's map." We have another map that future generations will implement. We must expand our territory from the Nile to the Euphrates. Look at the American Declaration of Independence. This declaration makes no reference to any specific boundaries. We are not compelled to define our borders. These were the words of former Israeli War Minister Moshe Dayan. He spoke of America, of occupation, the genocide of indigenous people, and land grab. In fact, Zionists had a strange plan. They wanted to model themselves after America and considered the conditions in a way that Palestine and its people resembled America and its native inhabitants. The Zionists saw themselves as sailors and explorers, with the difference being the Zionists considered the land of Palestine as their ancestral inheritance.
What kind of history is it that the Arabs live here for 2,000 years and they were kicked us, by us out? We lived here, sir, for the last 3,500 years and more. Now, we came back to the land of our ancestors.
In this way, all strategies used to occupy America were employed for occupying Palestine. Daydreaming begins. In their dreams, the Zionists rule over Palestine from the Nile to the Euphrates, the Middle East, and even the world. The existence of counterparts in America and Europe would have facilitated the establishment of geopolitical relations and brought about political power for Israel, making it akin to a kind of global government. But such mentalities were dangerous and found opposition. Therefore, the creation of an organization for suppressing opponents was put on the agenda. This organization is called Anti-Defamation League to suppress critics as a pressure group. With the increasing economic power of the Zionists, the Anti-Defamation League influenced the American political arena and even the Council on Foreign Relations. Zionists in America and Europe received support and backing, while critics and protesters were suppressed. The establishment of the Zionist regime was highlighted under the pretext of the Holocaust. All the documents related to the Holocaust were doubted. Years later, criticism begins, and critics are pursued and even punished. Some of the most significant criticisms and revelations came from within the intellectual communities. Ilan Pape, a professor of political science at the University of Haifa, addresses the issue of ethnic cleansing in Palestine in his book. Civilians were killed, villages were destroyed. At least 1 million men, women, and children were expelled from their homes. Ilan Pape faced harsh reaction and was expelled from the university. Gradually, other intellectuals also speak out. Israel had a sinister and complex political plan in the form of colonial occupation executed in a brutal manner. The situation was alarming because Israel's crimes could be concealed. Martial laws have been enforced in Palestine for years, infringing upon the rights and freedoms of the people who are simply harassed and abused.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah, the idea is that every Palestinian would feel the military is right here.
In fact, a dual judicial system had been established in Israel. Muslims were deprived of services, welfare, and basic rights.
And since 67, no more drilling, no more development, no more nothing. We stopped at this point.
They were arbitrarily detained and placed in narrow and solitary cells, mostly subjected to torture. Even though they were innocent, they were tried and sentenced in military courts. Strangely, upon release, they could be killed, even women and children. Israeli society bore many similarities to American society. Arabs were treated as African Americans, and they were more likely to be tried and imprisoned compared with the Zionists. A form of ethnic cleansing was underway, a combination of racism and systematic slaughter. The Zionists, who were complaining about Nazi German camps, had imprisoned Muslim people in a camp the size of Palestine.
This whole country is like a prison. We feel like birds in a cage. We have all the comfort and food we have, but we have no freedom. My life and existence is always being threatened.
Colonialism, apartheid, and occupation were underway. The immigrants did not have ideal conditions, especially those who arrived in Israel after the days of catastrophe or Nakba. They were not allowed to settle in large cities. Instead, they were settled in temporary camps and then transferred to settlements. The policy of settlement building was hostile. aiming to prevent the return of Palestinians and was considered a form of defensive shield. The protests of Eastern Jews began in the summer of 1959, starting from the city of Haifa. The next wave of protests took shape in the following decades. African immigrants also felt a different form of racial discrimination in their bones. As protests became widespread in Israel, Israeli experts and sociologists became involved and realized that something from within was challenging Israel. A crisis. Israeli sociologist Jonathan Shapiro in his books refers to the crisis as a major factor. The Israeli elites were exploiting the people. The necessity of creating a so-called nation for Israel was carried out at the expense of oppression by the majority, and minorities were in the worst situation. The chaotic situation of the parties was the most important factor in the crisis. There was no guarantee of minority rights. Arabs were in isolation and regression, being used as cheap labor for menial jobs. Israel was introduced as a model where a few different individuals from different countries had successfully come together and formed a nation. These were references to the Ashkenazis, as well as important institutions and organizations such as Haganah, Jewish Agency, Theodor Herzl, Weizmann, Menachem Begin, Ben-Gurion, Ariel Sharon, and Central Committees were all Ashkenazis. Historical books taught in schools were also about the Ashkenazis. Other Jews had no share in historical books because they were considered backward and primitive. Historically, being Jewish or Arab was not an issue. Jews lived comfortably among Arabs, but with the formation of Israel, problems arose. The Israeli society was filled with hatred towards Arabs. Arab immigrants were forced to hide their Arab identity. Concealing their Arab identity and constant suppression had turned into self-hatred. The solution ahead was what had been used in America, the melting pot theory. According to this theory, individuals from different societies come together in one place and interact, and a new society is formed. A new society that, while being homogeneous, also possesses the individual and social characteristics of different social groups. But Ben-Gurion's melting pot had many flaws. Racism was the most significant challenge. The next challenge was the rule of the elites. The founders of Israel sought to have Israel ruled by the elites, similar to America. Thus, a specific class in Israel was empowered as the guardians and protectors of the fundamental values of society to prevent the masses from challenging the fundamental principles of Israel. The plan had many benefits for the Ashkenazis. In the Jewish history, there are also signs of a class of nobility that sacrificed part of the Jews in times of emergency. A combination of racism and racial discrimination, along with the rule of a group of dominant elites and nobles who sacrifice people for their own interests. What fate will it bring? Politically, since 1949, left-wing parties have come to power in Israel and formed cabinets. In 1977, Menachem Begin of the Likud party came to power. In the 1980s, the Shah's party gained power, but again, it is Likud that takes the lead in Israel. In the 1990s, a young politician in Israel rises to power, Benjamin Netanyahu. He is U.S. educated with strong connections, including with Mitt Romney, the U.S. presidential candidate, and Menachem Schneerson, an influential rabbi. He shook hands with chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, plotted an assassination attempt on senior Hamas leader Khaled Meshaal, and has been embroiled in corruption and graft. But after the events of 2000 and Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon, Ariel Sharon comes to power. He is officially a criminal and has a long history of killing and crimes against Palestinians. In his record, the massacre of unarmed people in the village of Al-Kubaya and the Sabra and Shatila massacre stand out. The number of casualties resulting from Sharon's actions is never clear because he takes pleasure in burning Palestinians.
We warned.
When Sharon brings war and terror, he faces defeat. With Israel's defeat in the 33-day war, something in Israel is fundamentally hurt: security. The right-wingers attract people's attention with extremist slogans. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, who has the support of Jewish rabbis and American advisors, has a better position. He comes to power with numerous promises and, based on his business background, implements economic reforms to garner public satisfaction through economic growth. Ehud Barak was considered a tough opponent of Netanyahu's. In 1999, he came to power with a promise of ending the war in Lebanon. Ehud Barak was one of the main commanders in the Lebanon War. He had pursued advanced studies in systems analysis at Stanford University in America and logically had concerns about any Israeli action to take over Palestinian territories such as the West Bank, the Jordan River, and the Gaza Strip, which would officially lead to the formation of an apartheid regime. Because in the event of voting in Palestinian territories, Palestinians would definitely vote for the Palestinian government, posing a fundamental challenge to Israel. The Zionist solution to the problem was a perpetual siege and war with Palestine. That is why the Gaza Strip turned into a large prison. A few years later, when Ehud Barak becomes war minister, he proposes a solution to previous failures: war. During Operation Cast Lead, Israel attacks the Gaza Strip for 22 days. Phosphorus bombs rain down on the people. They attack rescue forces, hospitals, women, and even children. In this war, the infrastructure of Gaza is destroyed. Israeli soldiers abduct and use Palestinian children as human shields on the streets. Israel officially commits war crimes. However, this war did not bring any achievements. Ehud Barak, as a main culprit, steps aside to allegedly bring fresh blood into Israel's political system. He was seeking extensive changes, but his failure against the resistance leads to the resurgence of Netanyahu. On Until Netanyahu, security took precedence over everything in Israel, and every issue became a matter of security. But during Netanyahu's tenure, Israel faces a new challenge. The challenge of extremism. As long as Israel was winning, militarism was considered an honor. The army was the best interpreter of the Torah, and Arab defeats added to the excitement. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, who considered himself an expert in terrorism, turns to terrorism and, on the other hand, tries to achieve concessions through negotiations. And then he seeks to attract the satisfaction of extremist Zionists. That is why the provisions of the Madrid and Oslo Accords are replaced in the Trump Peace Plan, or so-called Peace to Prosperity. In 2018, discrimination becomes legally apparent in Israel, and Israel violates all international resolutions. According to this law, Israel is exclusively identified as a nation-state of the Jewish people, perpetually denying the rights and privileges of Muslims and restricting the Arabic language. In 2021, four families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem are ordered to leave their homes. They fall victim to the regime's strange judicial system, which confiscates Palestinian properties. A month later, a hardline representative, Itamar Ben-Gvir, sets up his office under a tent in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. He is an extremist Jew who had a picture of Baruch Goldstein fixed on the wall of his house. Goldstein was a terrorist who attacked unarmed worshippers during Ramadan, pouring their blood. When Ben-Gvir sets up a tent in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, the settlers storm in and the occupation of Palestinian homes begins. Creating tension and conflict, harassing and tormenting Muslims, forcing families to flee and replacing them with Jews, was a permanent policy for occupying land and changing the demographic and identity of Jerusalem and Palestine so that other plans could be implemented thereafter.
You are stealing my house!
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it!
But militarily, especially after the 33-day war in 2006, the conditions of the battlefield had changed. Therefore, when an Israeli ship is attacked in 2021, it becomes clear that it was a retaliatory attack. Subsequent attacks seem to be responses to Israeli crimes. Israel, which thought it had created a constant nuisance for the resistance axis by cooperating in the production of Daesh terrorists, now finds itself in the midst of even a greater fire. In a society where any unethical relationships to achieve a goal were considered legitimate based on its teachings, there's also a dangerous extremist movement that try to remain hidden and never be revealed.
The Arabs are not equal citizens here.
The extremist movement in the political arena of Israel was so influential that someone like Netanyahu, the main culprit in the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, came to power.
But he was there, and it didn't stop it.
The man in the blue t-shirt approached.
For this reason, Netanyahu tried to gather the approval of extremist groups for years.
To go back to Arab countries.
We have to kill him, and not because he's an Arab, because he's a terrorist. I think he should also kick out the family.
But extremism and racial discrimination not only face opposition from Palestinians, but also from the resistance front and other communities. Israel sees its security slipping away. Thus, Israel, which has historically oppressed people and plotted for the Middle East, finds itself on the path of contradictions in behavior and speech and the adoption of racist policies, leading to nothing but defeat and destruction.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We were discussing about some criteria that we need to keep in mind while choosing people, while recruiting people into managerial, very sensitive managerial positions, especially in government positions, in positions where we know that the society's future and the society's progress is dependent on those positions. We need to be really careful as to who we choose into these positions. And we say that Imam Ali alayhi salam in one of those phrases in the 53rd letter to Malik Ashtar, he says, وَتَوَخَّ مِنْهُمْ أَهْلَ التَّجْرِبَةِ وَالْحَيَاءِ, that choose amongst them, amongst the people, choose those that are people of experience and those who have shyness or bashfulness.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, in the previous session, we talked about the importance of experience. And we say that experience is very important, and of course, with all those explanations that we gave. Today we'll discuss about the other criteria, the other criterion that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, wal haya, that choose from amongst them people of shyness and people that have bashfulness. When it comes to people who are shy or bashful or they have this kind of, you know, chastity, let's say. What do we mean by that? See, when you talk about shyness, there are two types of shyness. There is a negative form of shyness and there is a positive form of shyness. The negative form of shyness is basically where a person does not want to do what is right, what is correct, what is necessary out of some form of shyness, like it feels that, you know, if I do that, what will people think, and what will that, I don't have the ability. So there's a mixture of lack of self-confidence together with a certain form of egoism or egotism that is mixed with this feeling, which is a negative form, because I'm very worried or concerned about what others would think or how it would look like if this type of action emanated from me. And this is a negative form of shyness. Of course, this is not what we are talking about in this particular statement where Imam alayhi salam says, Ahlal haya, people of shyness or people of chastity. Now, what we are talking about here is a positive form of shyness, whereby a person inside us, we have this feeling of not doing that which is wrong. Why? Because we feel shy. I feel shy in front of God to do this wrong thing. Let me give you a simple example. Like sometimes a person would feel shy to not wear certain clothes, let's say, in front of a certain area, a certain group of people. This is a positive form of shyness.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, see, as I said, shyness has both positive and negative dimensions. There's a group of people in this world who have this philosophy that, you know, you should never feel shy, should never have these feelings of chastity. This is a negative thing that stops you from doing, to be free, you know, and do whatever you want. Now, I want to just try and understand the psychology behind this. And of course, this is not the actual topic, but this is actually the reason why many negative trends have happened in the society. You know, they think that shyness in totality is a negative trait. And they think that it is actually a drawback in the progress of mankind. But I feel this is a very incorrect analysis of this very good feeling that Allah has kept in our hearts. You see, every feeling can have different sources and can have different manifestations. And depending on how it is manifested and for what reason it's manifested, it can be either good or it is bad. It can be bad. When shyness stops you to do what is wrong, when shyness stops you from performing that which is illegal, that which is against the will of God, that is a very good shyness. For example, a person would not want to come out of the house with shorts, right? Out of shyness. That's a very good thing. I mean, it's a good thing. I'm feeling shy to come out of my house with shorts. That's a very good thing for a man. I mean, he has to have certain levels of shyness. That is obvious. This is a very simple example that I'm giving. But in some parts of the world, they say, no, this shyness is negative. You should be able to do whatever you want. And, you know, this is going to create progress. I mean, what type of progress? I mean, these people have not even sat down to understand that these types of breaking of barriers are going to lead up to what situation. And you can see right now what is happening in the West with your eyes. See clearly what type of moral degradation the West has achieved because of these, you know, unholy ideas that have creeped into their minds. You see, gradually destroying the moral fabric of the society completely. And we are seeing this with our eyes, and we witness it. And we, of course, we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He protects us from these wretched ideas that can finally lead to the destruction of full societies. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we try to answer your questions and queries you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is an Islamic scholar and a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University, Qom, Iran. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you.
We have been discussing some of the very important teenage issues in previous sessions. And today we're going to discuss a very important topic, that is understanding and addressing teenage mental health issues, because that's a stage when a child goes through a lot of development. There are hormonal changes, there is stress, there is anxiety, there's also depression, and there are so many things they want to be isolated. But here parents have got a great role to do. And what is that? Professor Salman Nakavi will help us. Yes, Professor.
Yes, thank you very much. So we need to understand the basic issue. Basically, as much as we need to be concerned about the physical health of our children, and when our children become ill or they become physically injured or they're afflicted with a disease or there's an illness, we immediately take them to the doctor.
Right.
For treatment. And of course, we always say that prevention is better than cure. So in that sense also, we always try to maintain a an environment at, in the home which is clean, which is hygienic. So we need to, when we, the water we drink, the things we eat, we need to take care that they're cooked properly. For example, when you eat fruit, you wash it properly. Vegetables, you wash them properly, just to, you know, make your, them eating them make them safe for eating.
Right.
Because you're concerned for the physical health of your children, of yourself.
Right.
So you try to use fresh fruits, fresh food, meat, everything. Unfortunately, nowadays we're so used to frozen foods, which we forget that maybe it's not very good for our health. But
right.
still, we are concerned about physical health, and we do try to take measures to prevent injuries to our physical health. But unfortunately, we do not take care. We do not become so much concerned as we should be regarding mental health.
Right.
And mental health is much more important than physical health in the sense, yes, of course, physical health is important. If without it, your mental faculties may be very good, but you cannot employ them properly.
Right.
But still, if you are physically good, but your mental health is not good, then you have a problem. Then the physical body is not going to support you in those any good activity. It
Right.
is capable of doing so. It's like, for example, you have a good car. It's a modern car, but you don't have the proper fuel to run it. So the mental health is a very serious situation. Whether it's mental health, it has two facets to it. One is the proper thinking. Secondly, is the feelings and the emotions.
Right.
So we need to talk about both aspects. Thinking, if we are not, if our children have problems in thinking properly, if they have problems in analyzing things, if they have problems in getting to the truth of the matter, being
right.
creative, being able to evaluate. So those mental issues, those mental faculties, those mental capabilities, if they are problematic, they have problems, you need to solve those problems.
Right. Professor will be discussing more about this important issue with you after a short break. Tell listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing, and we are talking about mental health issues in teenagers and how can parents help them. Well, Professor, how important is it for parents to educate themselves? How important is it for parents to educate themselves on mental health and common teenage issues?
Yes, it's very important. As we were mentioning that for physical health, we are concerned. And nowadays, there's ample information on the net about any ailment, whether it is physical or mental. So you just press what you want, you get the answer, you find the indicators, the signs and the symptoms of an ailment, whether it is mental or physical. So it's very easy to get something useful. The useful information on the net of various physical and mental issues.
Right.
So we need to be, updated about
updated
these things.
And educated on those issues.
How
important is it here for, like, there are some introvert parents. They have that introvert behavior, but they really care about their kids. They really are concerned about their teenagers. But as the teenagers suffer those mental issues, how important is it for such an introvert parent to keep the communication lines open?
So being an introvert is not necessarily a negative thing. It's not that extroverts are very, you know, positive things and introverts are opposite to it. No, both inclinations are natural. So introverts have certain features or special characteristics which are better than those who are extroverts. So both have their downsides and both have their ups. But the important thing is the parents should be able to, number one, know what the problems and ailments are, and then be able to find the symptoms and know what the symptoms of the problem are, so they can diagnose the problem and then take the proper remedy and the proper steps. For example, in physical issues, so it's very clear, for example, your child is coughing, your child has a fever or is sneezing or whatever, so the symptoms are quite clear.
Right.
Or if there's an injury, it's obvious. But mental issues, as I was saying, there are two aspects to it. One aspect of mental health is thinking properly, and the second is the feelings and emotions which are there. And these are the issues regarding stress, anxiety, depression, and many of these situations and conditions, as you said, they're not visible. So you need to look for the signs. You need to look for the
symptoms,
and you need to know what the symptoms are. So we need to. We have been discussing some of the symptoms of anxiety and depression or whatever. And even sometimes a person who becomes so depressed, unfortunately, may lead to suicide, or a person would lead to self-injury or whatever. So we need to understand those situations. Sometimes they are conditions which come and go. They're not continuous. And sometimes they are conditions which are permanent, and they are permanent disorders which are there in as human beings in our children.
Right, and parents really need to look forward over those issues and help their teens to
compulsive disorder
to overcome
or
those.
Various disorders are there,
right,
which need to be taken care of.
Exactly, which need to be overlooked by parents and help their children to overcome those issues. We'll discuss more with you after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Naqvi, and we're discussing some of the very important points regarding the mental health issues of teenagers, which parents need to be considering while dealing with their teenagers. Well, Professor, there's one thing. Sometimes some of the parents, unfortunately, when they Allah gives them a child, they feel like it's their authority and now everything is in their control. Whatever they like, whatever they choose, whatever they want for that child, that's only a thing that's important. And as these teens develop, they face with such parents a judgmental environment, an unsupportive environment. How does this impact their mental health?
So such a child basically is being sometimes pampered, or on one extreme, the other extreme is he's being completely, you know, overlooked. And there's no concern about him. He's left on his own to do whatever he likes. And so both situations are extreme situations. Over-pampering too much, taking care of each and everything for the child will not allow him to develop into an independent adult. A person who can make the proper decisions at the proper time in the proper way and implement those. On the other hand, if a person is left on his own to develop as he likes, there are many children who grow up in the streets. They grow up in the outside
on the footpaths, like in India.
I mean, the parents are not at all concerned, or right. they can't be concerned. There are so many nowadays people, the poor people. Unfortunately, the poor people have so many kids.
Yeah.
The rich people go for lesser kids, whereas they can afford more kids.
More.
And where the poor people, they unfortunately have quite a lot of kids, and they don't have the resources to manage them, and they don't give the time to manage them. So unfortunately, the situation becomes, you know, out of control. So many, many people who are even not poor, they're of a middle level of society, they're working day and night to just make their ends meet regarding financial resources.
Right.
When is there time for them to give to their children? So they don't have the time for their children.
Right.
So the children are left on their own, and they're playing in the streets and growing up in the streets, and the parents are not concerned with what's happening. So both situations are problematic.
Right.
We need to take a middle path. We need to manage our time with the children, give them time, but teach them how to swim, not to make them swim or make them teach them to learn
the skill of swimming.
The skills. As they say, teach them how to fish. Don't right. catch the fish for them.
Wow.
So that is important, that we need to teach our children how to do things.
Right.
Not to do them for them.
Right. Well, that was really very helpful information that you could have shared with us on the mental health of teenagers. And parents, please be supportive. Please be non-judgmental while you're dealing with your teens. And be patient, basically, and understanding as well. And identify the warning signs that your teen may be struggling with their mental health. And as the professor said, stay informed on mental health issues, and you can actually involve your teen in decision-making related issues, and also actually engage them in physical activity so that they can overcome their mental stress. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the topic of our fragile peace process. How does peace now look 25 years on from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement? Has common ground been made by former enemies, or are we as polarised as ever? My next guest served under the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Depending on which side of the political divide you come from, the RUC were seen as the protectors of a community or an oppressive force against another. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is a current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and Chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Sam Thompson. Sam is a former member of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. He experienced the loss of a number of colleagues and friends and saw numerous killings and bombings during the conflict. Sam retired in 2008 and has expanded on his love of history and is now a lecturer. Sam, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Sean.
So, Sam, you grew up not far from where we're sitting now, a very different place from this side of the wall. Do you want to tell us a bit about your childhood?
Yes, well, I came in this world, I was born in the Royal Victoria Hospital up the road, but the first house I was brought home to is Dundee Street, just on the other side of the Peaceline. So all four of my grandparents all lived within about 300 yards from here. My grandfather would have grown up on 9th Street, which runs down into Conway Street. So I was very familiar with that lower Shankill area when I was young, even though my parents moved to Ballysillan. My grandparents continued to live down there, so I was basically brought up in between the two.
And Sam, you joined the RUC. What motivated you to do that, and what was its reputation like when you joined it?
Right, in terms of motivation, I joined it pretty much by default. I didn't really know what to do with my life, and I'm now at the stage where I'm retired and I still don't really know what to do with it.
What year did you join and what age were you?
I joined in 1979. And I was 18 and about 4.5 months by the time I went in. So it was basically the economy here was imploding. The place was rapidly deindustrialising. And it was one of the few things that had any job security. Now, in terms of reputation, there was none of the baggage in the unionist community regarding the RUC. And my first memory of them is actually quite a positive one. I went to Cliftonville Primary School, and it must have been either 1970 or 1971. Our school sports day was attacked by bigger kids from around the Bone area. And the teachers got us off with all the rum. Like, they're just coming over and chucking bricks and stuff at us. And feeling absolutely terrified. And the police arrived down in the school, and I remember feeling reassured and safe at the sight of the police uniform. Now, as I got older, 1970s was quite a brutal period, and up around Ballysillan, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but like the word in the school was, if you messed about with Tennant Street or you got arrested, you would get a hiding. And as this will sound absolutely weird to many of your, but the idea that if you're arrested, you're going to get beaten up by the police. Nobody thought this was strange. But on the unionist side of the house, that was very much a thing too. But things have to change. So you can either say, well, that's the way things are, or you can try and change them in a more positive way.
And once you joined the RUC, I'm sure you were a member of the RUC for 28 years then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there a certain period or a time where... And I'm sure there were many dark times. Mm-hmm. Was there something that stuck out in particular?
Oh, well, there were so many things, like particularly the first lot of years when I was in uniform. You remember, like, the severe incidents, you know, when people have been shot and things like that, and all these sort of bloody things, they tend to stick in your mind. The thing which travels with me the most, and I wasn't even there, was my best friend was killed during a hunger strike. And this is why the sort of Republican celebration of it tends to stick in me a bit. There's a lot of people died during that didn't want to die. And he was blown up on the 7th of September, blown to pieces basically, only identifiable by fingerprints, just turned 20 years of age. And he had been transferred to Pomeroy, and that was his first day on duty. He was there for an hour and 5 minutes. And I still think about him and about that quite often. And then there's other people that know quite well as well. But, you know, you carry these things through your life.
I think we're all scarred by what happened. And I suppose during your time in the RUC, Do you ever have the urge to join a paramilitary organisation, or were you ever pressurised to do
that? Absolutely not. And even when I was growing up in Ballyselin, which